them. Don't assume they're sisters. Don't assume they're best friends. They may not have a connection. It's up to you to find out.
So this book has more twists and turns than the Mekong River. It's continually surprising. Was Blood Sisters completely planned out before you started it?
No, it wasn't really. I knew roughly what I wanted to do. I had the germ of the idea. I knew my characters and I let them take the lead. I put them in a tricky situation and they grew. They grew within me and they became different in many ways than the kind of characters I thought they were going to be. That's the wonderful thing about writing a novel. You start off with the boat, the vessel, but you're not sure exactly where it's going. I find that if I plan things down to the very last detail, it doesn't work. Having said that, you do need some kind of structure. And my initial structure changed along the way. And that can happen too. And that's a good thing. You need to be flexible as a writer.
So flexible on yourself and the story and the characters.
Flexible and at the same time contained. So you need to be able to give the characters their head, a bit like riding a horse and they want to go faster. You let them keep giving their head, but at the same time, you let them know who is in control.
Even though much of the book is set in a prison and a home for adults with special needs, I was laughing out loud. Now, was that on purpose,
Jane? Yeah, definitely, definitely on purpose. I think there's a very fine line between tragedy and comedy. I remember Simon Brett saying that years ago, and it was before I was published, and I recall thinking, how can that be? But actually now I know exactly what he means. When I worked in a high-security male prison as writer of residence, many of us laughed while we were working. How did we laugh? We would crack jokes sometimes. We would try to put a smile on our faces because otherwise you couldn't cope.
It's sort of to relieve the tension. You can have had black humour.
Yes, it's almost gallows humour, actually. Yeah, yes. Yeah. And I knew that if I had a character who was in a home, which is what Kitty is. She's in a home. You don't know how old she is. You don't know why she's there. She can't remember why she's there. People don't think she understands them, but actually Kitty does. She knows very well what they're talking about, but she can't remember why she's there. Now, that could have become very depressing. So I made her funny, and I wasn't sure how to do that until I spent quite a lot of time for my research in centres for people who had been severely disabled. And I was told that when people had head injuries, they quite often swore a lot. And they weren't aware that they were being rude, and they would say things as they were. So, for example, if a very large woman entered the room, they might shout out, "Who's had too many buns then?" And I remember this was an example given to me by a member of staff at one of the centres. And I thought, I can do this with Kitty. I can make her funny so that it's not terrible pathos all the time, but you want Kitty to be all right. You want her to be happy and you want to laugh with her and you want to cry with her too.
Yes, yes. So tell me, how did they allow you into these places if they knew you were doing research?
Actually, my background is in journalism, and it's much easier to research for a novel because people know their real names aren't going to be used. So I used my journalist tenacity, as it were, to ring various places and say, look, I'm writing this book. It helps hugely to say I'm published by Penguin. So writing this book, it's commissioned by Penguin, and I need to find out about X, Y, and Z. I don't need to use any names. I just need to understand how people tick, how it works. And actually, many people are very good about that. They're pleased that somebody's researching something properly, and that's how it goes.
Because in a way, she can have had locked-in syndrome. That's how I see it. Like, her brain worked okay, apart from... Well, she can have had short-term and long-term memory problems. But I love the way she called the people all these hysterical names as well. Yes. That was really funny.
Kitty has a very precise way of identifying people. So she may not know their names, but she will call her carers by different names. So there'll be thin carer or fussy carer or new carer or whatever. And I always try to put myself into my characters' bodies to see the world through their eyes. So when I went into these centres and talked to the people there, I imagined, and one can only imagine, I mean, because it's to actually say I know how they're feeling would be ridiculous, but I try to imagine what it would be like to be in their situation.
So you met people and they literally had brain damage, I suppose born with it, accidents, and they couldn't walk. I mean, she only has one arm that works and she's in a wheelchair.
Mm. There are varying... I met people with varying degrees of disabilities. Some made me want to go home and weep, like the young man who'd been knocked off his motorbike and was now literally in a home full-time, able to do very little. There was the woman that I met who her colleagues at work thought she was being rude and abrupt, and in actual fact she had a brain tumour growing, and when it was taken out affected her mobility and the way she thought and talked, but also at the same time she was able to converse with me, which was extraordinary. And the staff were wonderful. I mean, my hat goes off to these incredible people who work for not very much money, looking after people and doing a job that many of us would find very hard to do.
But what's interesting about Kitty was, you say that we feel sorry for her, but we also are shocked by her because she does have bad thoughts.
Oh, yes.
And I think that's what's really, really daring of you, Jane, to write a book with a character who's disabled, sorry, special needs, it's got to be PC, who is literally having bad thoughts and being quite negative about life.
Well, you see, I often think that we generalise about old people. We think all old people are sweet. What we forget is they could have been extremely nasty people when they were younger. They possibly still are extremely nasty people. So we shouldn't generalise. It's like saying all women like the colour blue or pink or whatever. And so why should people with special needs all be nice? Why should people who are not, I don't like to use the word disabled, but why should people who are able-bodied be good or not good? These generalisations are very dangerous. So I wanted to take a character who actually had been quite tricky before she was this way.
Yes, yes.
And her parts of this personality, that character, is going to continue inside her body. So why should she be different? But Kitty does learn things along the way. And then, of course, there's Alison.
Yes, got to get to Alison.
Yes. Yeah.
So she's the one that works, she's an artist,
she's an artist.
The one that gets a job, again, work, and it's paid for, going into prisons and doing art.
That's
so you've
right.
done the same thing as writer in residence.
Yes, and I did come across artists in residence. None of them were like Alison, but I love art. It's in my genes, it's in my family. A lot of us have dabbled. I did actually have quite a famous great-great-great-grandfather who was an artist. And I have painted in watercolours for many years, and I went to a stained glass workshop about 4 years ago and was fascinated by it. It was something I'd always wanted to do, and when I was working out what job I wanted to give Alison, I knew I wanted it to be arty. I didn't want it to be watercolours. I wanted it to be something slightly different and edgy that might fit in with Plaza's
List. Edge is the word.
Edge is the word. So I took myself off to a couple of stained glass workshops on top of the one I'd done 4 years ago. I made some stained glass panels, and I learnt the most enormous amount, which I hope is reflected in the book. Not in vast detail, but you only need those odd sentences to show, hopefully, that this is somebody who has done some stained glass.
Yeah,
herself.
I was impressed because you're going on about bending the metal.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh. Now, I also want to ask, you've been, obviously what's really interesting about the book, apart, it is a brilliant book, by the way, everyone has to go out and buy it, is that you really get to know what it's like to be in a prison. And these prisoners are, they're needy, they are manipulative, and they are dishonest. And one of the things they say is, don't get too close to a prisoner. Did this happen to you at all?
No, it didn't. I mean, I'd just like to go back on what you said. Some prisoners are exactly as you describe. There are others who are in prison almost by a quirk of fate. Somebody who's made the wrong decision. And we've all made wrong decisions. But their wrong decisions have led to terrible things. So not all prisoners are needy and manipulative, but, you know, there are a fair number there as well. Did I get close to any of them? I do think that there is a maternal streak in many women, including myself, where you want to fix things, you want to make things right. And certainly when I worked there 2 days a week for 3 years, I wanted to make it all right for the men. I wanted to help them through what I was doing to become decent, honourable citizens and to patch things up. But that isn't the case. That can't be. They've actually created carnage in somebody else's family in many instances, and you can't make it better. So I did have to be aware that there were boundaries that one must never cross. I mean, I'm not saying that I would agree with personal relationships between staff and prisoners, because that's obviously wrong, and that was something I would never have considered myself.
It must happen.
But it does happen, and I have heard of that happening between staff.
Of course, because we're human. Teachers fall in love with their pupils.
Precisely.
Look at the new president.
Exactly. But it goes back, I think, to this nurturing instinct, this need to make everything all right. But the other really important factor for me in the book was this huge relationship between sisters, because I'm not quite sure there's anything like it.
Do you have a sister, Jane?
I do have a sister, and I love her very much. I would actually jump under a bus for her without a moment's hesitation, and I don't say that lightly. She's my younger sister, when there's just the two of us, and our mother died when she was only in her 50s, and I know that's provided a very strong bond between us. Sometimes I think I'm very different from my sister. Sometimes I think I'm uncannily like her. And I think many sisters feel that way.
The book does deal with so many issues and subjects which in Britain are still taboo. Did you do that consciously?
Can you give me some examples?
Well, just, the mental home, the prisons, all the things that we sort of don't really talk about in society.
Yes, it's true. I think I've always been the kind of person that wants to do things that maybe are slightly risky, which doesn't really go with my image, because I'm quite a quiet, seemingly quiet person.
Self-contained, I'd say.
I don't know about being self-contained.
Yeah. No, you look it physically, you've got your own aura about you, you're not... Well, you've got a writerish aura.
Thank you, yes. My mother used to say I was quietly determined, and I think she was right. I think if somebody tells me I can't do something, my immediate instinct is to do it. So, for example, when this job came up at the prison, my sister did actually say, you've just got divorced, you're not in a great place, you're mad. So I accepted the job. I want to climb hills that others haven't. And I do want to do things. I mean, I swim in the sea. We moved to the southwest a few years ago when I got married again. And I swim in the sea 9 months of the year. And there have been times when I've swum and I shouldn't have swum. And I think I've learnt my lesson. But sometimes, yes, I mean, I do like to take risks.
Fantastic. And I did notice that Alison was tall and blonde and she lived in Devon.
Come on.
Which is you.
Yes, Alison doesn't swim. Oh. But maybe she will.
Oh, wonderful. So, Jane, you're on a roll now of these thrillers. I mean, you're with Penguin, you've been writing for years, but you are literally selling out. And I just got to ask, because Blood Sisters came out so quickly after after your last book, what are you writing on? Come on, tell us a little bit.
Well, actually, Blood Sisters is coming out a year after My Husband's Wife. And My Husband's Wife was incredibly exciting because... I mean, I feel slightly embarrassed saying this. Not only did it get to the bestseller list of the Sunday Times, but also on the Washington Post bestseller list when it came out in the States last month. And so, in fact, it's just been a year. And many people do write a book a year. But you're quite right. I am in the middle of next year's book. I can't give you the title yet because it's not out. But it is consuming me, as it always does when I write a novel. And I have just finished the first draft, so now I'm going back and working on it. I never show the first draft to anybody. It's due in with my wonderful editor in the first week of July.
Can I just ask, prisons?
It has got a prison element. For my research, I spent some time in a women's prison last month. The governor was good enough to let me in. That wasn't easy, actually. That was quite tricky, finding my way into a women's prison. And but it's not just about prisons. It's about family relationships, because my books are about human family relationships that are stretched to the brink through something that's happened to somebody in the family. The genre can be described as domestic noir. I once joked in an interview that my entire life was domestic noir at times. That's not totally true, but like many people, we've had our ups, you know, one has had one's ups and downs, and I feel myself to be very lucky and